Each week, as part of our worship, we set aside a special time of communion to be with Jesus and remember Jesus. And on the first Sunday of the month, we like to share communion early in the service when we have all of our ages together. The word communion means coming together and sharing deep thoughts and feelings from our hearts. And communion is something that Jesus asked his followers to do, to share our deep thoughts and feelings with him. And he wants us to remember how much we are loved and that we're forgiven no matter what kind of messes we have caused. We don't need to be ashamed. We don't need to be afraid. God has great things planned for us when we're connected and listening to Jesus. And communion is an important way that we connect. It can be easy to forget our connection to Jesus. We're so busy, especially this time of year. But Jesus says, "Remember me." God wants us to remember everything that Jesus did to show us his perfect love. Jesus was born, and he lived, and he died because of perfect love. So every week, we come together in this room, and we eat a piece of bread, drink a little juice, just as Jesus did at the end of his human life on earth, and we remember him. At Cedar Ridge, each family gets to decide when their child or children should be sharing communion, and everyone is welcome at communion here. You can come to one of these tables here or have communion with the ministers at the side doors and receive the bread and cup, and it's all gluten-free. You can also pray with a prayer partner in the back or write your prayers out on the sides, and there'll be some suggestions on the screen of ways you might want to spend this communion time. Now you please join me in a responsive prayer. Do we have a responsive prayer? Yes. God of all love and light, thank you for being here with us today. Thank you that you love us and protect us. This Advent, we celebrate the birth of your Son, Jesus. Jesus was born long ago, but his Spirit is here with us every single day. Jesus came to make us all one, to bring us together into God's love, peace, and hope. We remember this truth through the bread and the juice. Lord of all, through this communion, remind us that we walk in your light and hope. Please help us carry your love and healing to a hurting world. Amen. In the Bible, it tells us that on the night before Jesus was killed, he shared a meal with his friends, and he took bread and blessed it, and then he broke it. And he said, "Take, eat. This is my body broken for you." And then he took a cup of wine, and he thanked God and gave it to his friends, and he said, "Drink this. It's my blood. It's God's new covenant, God's promise, poured out for us, for you, for everyone, for the forgiveness of sins." God invites you to come to the table just as you are. As we take communion together, let's remember God's great love and mercy through these gifts. Amen.
Thanks, everybody. If you'd like to take a seat. Good to see you all here. My name's Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here. We, as you probably know, we have this partnership with the town of Ipala in Guatemala. And some of our friends from there, the people that we've been getting to know over the last 6 or 7 years, have a little message for us. It's kind of a Christmas greeting. So we're going to watch that on a video right now.
En nombre de todos los estudiantes becados, queremos dar un agradecimiento muy sincero a ustedes, hermanos de Maryland, por su ayuda, así como también los niños que fueron beneficiados en la compra de libros de Victoria para aprender a leer y escribir, la Academia de Computación CIDER y los salones de clases que se construyeron este año. Les damos nuestro más sincero agradecimiento y gracias, hermanos americanos, por apoyar la educación en Ipala.
En nombre de las familias felices, de Laurenas, Techo Mínimos, Piso Mínimos y de la casa que se viene a hacer cada año, damos las gracias por todo lo que han hecho por hacer feliz y cubrir esa necesidad.
Entre los múltiples proyectos que han realizado, sin lugar a dudas, lo que es salud es uno de los más gratificantes. Cuando se entrega a un niño desnutrido su porción de leche, cuando miramos de la manera en la que va subiendo, en nombre de esos niños, muchísimas gracias. En nombre de las personas que fueron con el médico y no tienen para comprar su medicina, están con su receta médica, ustedes le están proveyendo para que puedan comprar su medicina. Muchísimas gracias, que Dios les bendiga.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. God bless you.
Okay, so just wanted to, particularly in reference to the video, just encourage everybody. We're coming close to the end of the year, and we are in our year-end giving campaign at the moment. So I just want to encourage everybody to give generously. We do a lot of work in Guatemala, a lot of work in the surrounding community. Running this place obviously takes money, and that money comes from people like you and me, people who are committed to this church, who value this community. So I just want to encourage all of us in these last few weeks to dig deep and give generously. I just want to say thank you, too, for the incredible generosity throughout the year. I'm always amazed at how we pay our bills, reach our goals. You know, we always do it, and that's down to, you know, faithfulness and commitment and perseverance. So thank you for all the giving throughout the year. Let's close out strongly. So you can make donations online. You may have recently uploaded our new app that we were talking about last week. You can make donations that way. We've got the offering boxes at the back. You can leave offerings at the side. You can come and hand cash over to me and use banknotes. That's all. It's all appropriate. Okay, so let's give generously as we head into the new year. Okay, if you're an elementary age or below, you're going to head out now to your various programs. So preschoolers, you're going to head out through those doors. Elementary, through those doors over there. Everybody else has to stay put, no escaping. And why don't you just turn to the person next to you, say hello, greet one another, maybe chat about what are you most looking forward to about Christmas this year? Okay, Good to see you back again. Just want to say, if you're new here, thank you so much for coming. We're really glad to have you here. Hope you feel very much at home with us. Some simple ways to get to know us a little bit better, and for us to get to know you. A really straightforward one is just to check out the flyer you got when you came in. It's got lots of information about upcoming happenings and activities. Do check that out. And on the back page, you'll see there's a section there you can tear off. Just fill out your contact details. If you drop that in those wooden boxes I mentioned earlier, or at one of the baskets at the side of this room, or in the welcome table outside, would love to follow up with you with an email and just make some contact with you that way. You can also come and see us after the service. We do Cedar Ridge in 7 minutes. It's a quick, brief overview of our church. We'll share a little bit about our story with you, answer any questions you have. We meet in that corner over there right at the end of the service, so do please come back and see us. Everybody, please do check out the flyer. It's the hot off the press, new copy, so it's got lots of information there. You can also find out more about what's going on our website too. Last night, how many people came to the Christmas party last night? Yeah, we had a lot of fun, some great food, some great wine, some gift buying. I think we have a few photos from that from last night. Yes, we've got a few photos, so those will be rolling through. The fun's not over yet, okay? So for about 30 minutes after the service, over in the barn, you can still go and shop over there. We have some, it's 10,000 Villages, and what's the other organization called? These? Oh, okay, it's just 10,000 Villages, okay? So 10,000 Villages, we've got some of their products, some great Christmas shopping, all for a really great cause too. So head over to the barn, but it'll be 30 minutes, that's it. So don't hang around, get over there and do your shopping right after the service. Okay, a couple of things we want to mention. First one, it is Advent, of course. We have our Advent calendars still available. This is the second Sunday of Advent now, so we're sort of well into Advent. But we've got these really wonderful calendars. You can pick up a copy of these, package of these at the back there over on at the side. And we've also got them outside. And you just cut these cards up, and they've got some really great activities to do every day. Go to our website, you'll see some more information about it, and also a little video explaining it. You could grab one of these and give them to neighbors or a friend if they want to go along with it. They're not like overly religious or anything like that. We don't want to get religious at Christmas, do we? but they're great little things, so check those out if you haven't got one of those already. Also wanted to mention, next Saturday, we will be having an Advent quiet day over in the barn. What time does that start, Melanie? 10 o'clock, okay, and till 3:30. Sorry, it's just not on my thing here. So 10 to 3:30, everybody is welcome to that. There's a sign up in the lobby on the welcome desk there, so if you want to come along. We'll be spending a lot of that time in silence, practicing certain prayers. Read about it in the flyer I was mentioning about, and also some information about that online. Really encourage everybody to take advantage of that. At a time of year that tends to be anything but quiet, right? It can be pretty hectic one way or another. Also on the subject of, we talked about Guatemala earlier and our support of the that town, Ipala. We, as we have been doing for several years, we also have opportunities to buy smokeless stoves. If you go over to the barn afterwards, you'll be able to buy a stove over there. There's a setup there where you can sign up to buy one. And you can also look at our website and our bulletin, our flyer will give you information about that too. But it's an opportunity to buy a stove. Yep. Oh, you're going to be in the commons, so you won't be in the barn. Okay. So if you want a stove, go out into the commons. Okay. So now you don't have to carry the stove away with you, so you don't need to back up your truck or anything. You just basically buy one. You could buy one for yourself or for somebody else, and it then gets donated to a family in Ipala. And it means that the design of these stoves mean that there's no smoke in the house, and that has obviously great cooking benefits, but also great health benefits for these families who are otherwise cooking over open fires, and it has detrimental effect. So all that is going to a really great cause. So check out the website, check out the flyer, go to the commons afterwards, get all the information you can, and you could buy one of those and maybe give it as a gift to somebody for Christmas this year. Okay, I think that's it in terms of announcements. Did I miss anything there, Sarah? I don't think I did. Good. Okay, so I'm going to light the first Advent candle, because we lit that last week, and it was the candle representing hope. So I'm just going to light that again now, because I'm actually going to talk a little bit about hope today. There we go. We're going to talk a little bit about hope today, although the Advent theme this week is peace. So I've got to somehow work those two together. We'll see how that goes. We're going to read the story of Christmas this morning. We're going to look at this story. Now, this story is, I think, probably for most of us, very, very familiar, right? It's something we read every year. It's probably one of the sections of the Bible that most people are fairly familiar with. You know, if you've read the Bible at all, these are the stories that we probably have heard before. So we're going to have two lots of readings this morning. I'm going to invite Devon. Do you want to come up and Olivia? They're going to read for us first. And you guys are reading from the Gospel of Luke, right? So this we're going to hear some of the Christmas story from Luke and then some of the Christmas story from the Gospel of Matthew. I'm going to ask a few questions afterwards. So listen to it. Try to listen with fresh ears. It's hard to do that, but try and imagine taking this story in for the first time as these guys read to us. Thank you. So that's Luke's account. Luke has Jesus from Nazareth, right? So, Jesus is, by all accounts, from Nazareth, and they have to make this journey to Bethlehem because of a census being taken. Matthew tells the story slightly differently. According to Matthew, Jesus is from Bethlehem and ends up in Nazareth a different way. And Oliver and Colin are going to come and read to us now. And just the Matthew version of this story, which is it's the same story from a slightly different perspective. That story, some would say the story in Luke is more from Mary's perspective. Some would say the story in Matthew is more from Joseph's perspective. You could look at it that way, perhaps. But let's listen to another part of the story from Oliver and Colin.
Asked them where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem, in Judea, they replied, "For this is what the prophet
Excellent. Thanks, guys. Let's give those all those readers a big round of applause. Great job. Excellent. Let's just put it there. What did you notice about that story? What stuck out to you, maybe for the first time, or just because it was reinforced for you? Obviously, there's a lot of stuff going on in that story. But anything stand out to you? I mean, any impressions? Anyone want to share anything? Yeah. Dan. Yeah. 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 Okay. So what, for those that didn't hear what Dan was saying, there was that this government, you know, power in both stories. Government. You got on the one hand, Augustus Caesar in Luke, and Quirinius the governor. It's a difficult word, that Quirinius, the governor, deciding there's a census, and so they have to move. People have to move around, and travel. And in the second story, we've got Herod killing all these young boys in order to kill Jesus or try and kill Jesus. Anything else that strikes you? Yeah. Matthew's constantly saying this happened in order to fulfill the prophecy. Great. Thanks, Sarah. Yeah. So, here.
Just how many times having dreams
where
the people were given information through their dreams?
Yeah, a lot of dreaming.
It really stood out to me.
Okay, that struck you. Yeah, sort of. And that's, I mean, perhaps there's that sense of God's presence, right? God. There's communication going on. There's,
but they had to be open to it.
Right, and openness. Yeah, great point. Yeah. Anybody else? Anything? Yes.
In this time when we're dealing with so many refugees in our world today, it just struck me how often Jesus, Mary, and Joseph had to flee
and were
refugees themselves.
Yeah. In both stories. Mm-hmm. They're making journeys in both stories. And not because of decisions they've made, because of decisions other people have made, or situations that were out of their control. Yeah, that's good. We have one more. Anybody want to? It's typical, isn't it, Sarah? And then we'll have that last one over in the far corner. Over. No, we'll call it a day there. You got the last word, Jimmy.
Okay. Well, I noticed that at first they got a message that it was safe to return, that the people who wanted to kill them were dead. But then soon after that, they got I don't know if it was a vision or a dream, that said, that warned them to take shelter and that it wasn't safe.
Yeah.
So I hadn't noticed that before. It was sort of like there's a certain fluidity to the instructions they were getting. It was sort of like, you're safe, be careful. And it's just sort of like,
and it kind of changes.
It wasn't just one concrete pillar, you know, sort of like very fluid.
That's a really interesting observation. Yeah, that. So, you know, they, it's not like the whole, there's this whole plan, but it's like, you know, they're taking a step at a time and things are changing. It's a very fluid, dynamic situation. Yeah. Well, the thing that strikes me, and a number of you have brought this out, the thing that strikes me about this story is that it's a story that is, on the one hand, it's very hopeful, and it's, you know, I mentioned we're talking about hope today. It's very hopeful. It's got some beautiful things in it, right? And the sort of things that we tend to emphasize at Christmas time. I mean, I think we perhaps overly glamorize this story. We overly beautify this story to a certain degree. And we emphasize things like the angels. You know, there were angels in the story. Nobody mentioned that, actually. Nobody referenced that as an unusual thing. We have some dreaming, you know, and clearly the presence of God. There's a sort of divine presence in this story. With unusual things happening. There's a star that appears and guides these magi to their destination. So there's these sort of fantastic things. But actually, overall, I think the story, in many ways, is a very dark story, right? It's a story about tyranny. We've got Augustus Caesar directing Quirinius to carry out a census that was really oppressive. Basically, that was about counting people to make sure that enough taxes were taken. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that that event, doing that census, sparked and ignited and brought together a lot of the revolutionaries in Palestine at that time, particularly in the Galilean region where Nazareth is. And, you know, it's the beginnings of the Zealot Party, the political movement that wanted to overthrow through armed means the Roman Empire, that movement got its... it didn't exactly start then, but it catalyzed that movement. There was an attack on a Roman garrison not long after that, just a few miles from Nazareth. That was kind of one of the touch points that really sort of took off in terms of the rebellion. So, you know, this was an oppressive act. We've mentioned already refugees. So, you know, think about it. Herod is killing all these kids. I mean, it's unbelievably atrocious. It's an unbelievably dark thing. And Jesus has to flee. His family have to flee. They go down to Egypt. And then they come back, and as we mentioned already, they're kind of scared again. They're moving around. There's a lot that is dark and sinister and difficult. There's a lot of poverty going on, right? We know that Galilee was a very poor area. Nazareth, in particular, was a very poor town. So there's a lot of difficulty and struggle and darkness and oppression and vulnerability in this story. And we can, I think it's very easy for us to pass over that because, for instance, you know, you take that journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem, you know, the journey that Luke talks about. Well, that's about 100 miles. Mary presumably was very pregnant. There's no mention of a donkey in that story. Did you hear that? You know, on all the Christmas cards, there's always a donkey, right? Mary's on the donkey. There's no mention of a donkey in that story. So, you know, maybe there was a donkey. Maybe there was a horse and cart. Who knows? But we're not told about that. They had to make that trek. Probably took them well over a week to make that journey. Really difficult journey to make. So there's a lot of painful struggle. And as somebody mentioned, I think, there's a lot of things that don't seem in control. So we have a couple of ways we can look at the story. We could read this story, as I think we tend to do, and as I think to some degree the stories are written, as though there's this great plan, like God has this plan, it's all mapped out, and you know, it's a bit scary here and there, and there's some, you know, some twists and turns to the plot, but basically God's got it all under control, and everything's going to be okay, and it's, you know, the darkness is just to add a bit of excitement to the story, right? That's one way of reading it, and that's the way we read it when we know the end of the story, right? We tend to, because without giving the plot away, you know, about Christmas and everything, but we know what happens, right? We know the story. So we are reading it with that kind of objectivity. We're somewhat removed from it. If you're in that story, and I want to try and encourage us to maybe read it from that perspective, if you're in that story, I think you it's a very different experience, right? It's an experience of a plan. What kind of a plan is this? We're being threatened. I mean, this is not a story about control. This is just the miracle of Christmas, let's say, is that God with us means God is being vulnerable. God is coming into this story and risking death, risking being snuffed out, risking the whole plan going to hell, if you'll pardon the expression. So we have two ways of looking at it. I want to encourage us to look at it and read this story from the second perspective. And there's a couple of reasons, three reasons I would suggest that we do that. One, because my story is not one where everything is planned out perfectly, right? You know, I turned 50 this year, and I've been doing a lot of sort of reflecting, looking back, and we do that at certain times of year. We do that, I think, towards the end of any year, and we do a lot of that, I think, at Christmas time. We kind of look back and reflect on life in general. Has anybody's life ever worked out the way they planned it? Or has anybody had a totally free ride, you know, where everything's gone perfectly, beautifully? Right, we have all kinds of difficulties in our lives, all kinds of struggles, all kinds of things that don't seem to make sense, all kinds of things that frankly don't seem very fair. And when we look at the world, here's the second reason, the world seems desperately unfair. If there is some great plan, it feels like it favors certain people and doesn't favor others. And that doesn't seem very fair at all. If you're rich and powerful and successful and you've got lots of control over things, then life's going to be pretty much okay for you. But if you're not born in the right country or at the right place or at the right time, life's going to be a struggle, and that is most of our reality, right? That's how it is. We are all dealing with things right now that are really difficult in our lives. We're facing death, we're facing grief, we're facing loss, we're facing difficulties in relationships, we're facing all kinds of things, some of which are as a result of things we've done, you know, so you could say we have some control over them. Most of which, though, we do not have 100% control of, and some of which we have virtually no control over whatsoever. Like, things like government decisions, like Augustus Caesar and Quirinius or Herod, and things where stuff just happens, right? And that's how life is for most of us. I also think it's how life was for most of the people reading and writing even these stories originally. If you think about it, the early Jesus movement, the early church, was persecuted, suffered, had all kinds of calamity going on. And I think we're asking a lot of questions and puzzling through, like, what's going on? Where is God in all of this? There's an expectation clearly from the early scriptures that Jesus, who had died and come back to life and then wasn't present anymore, was going to come back. And part of the reason why they started writing stories down eventually was because they realized that Jesus wasn't coming back anytime soon. And so there's potential there for disappointment and disillusionment and a sense of lostness. And so what we have here is a story that I think gives meaning in that kind of context in a different way than if we assume that it's all this wonderful, beautiful fairy tale story that's all mapped out and planned out, and it was actually a beautiful story to be in. It's a difficult story to be in. But I think that makes it more relatable, right? We can connect with this story in a different kind of way. We can connect with hope in this story in a different kind of way, because this is about hope in the here and now, in the darkness, in the nitty-gritty of life, in the trenches, if you like, of life, in the struggle of life, rather than hope just being something in the future. Now, clearly, hope does have something to do with the future, okay? And we look forward to a time where maybe our problems will be overcome, or where tears will be wiped away. We look forward to another era in our lives, if you like, or another era even in our existence, in our reality. But hope has to have a reality in the present. And I think what we're seeing in this story, and what, for me, the miracle of Christmas is that God is coming into all this darkness. God is present in this difficulty. And not only that, God enters into the suffering, enters into the failure, enters into all that darkness with us. That's what Christmas is about. It's about Emmanuel, God with us. God is with us in all of this, rather than outside of it, controlling it all and moving everybody around like pawns, right? In one reading of the story, those powers that be are just pawns in God's hands, and God's moving them. Oh, let's have a bit of death and violence. They can do this. They can make this decision. In another way of reading the story, those powers that be are, to a certain degree, a law unto themselves, making bad choices, evil choices, dark choices, to which we and the rest of the world then become subject. But God is with us in that subjectivity. God is in with us in that darkness. God is with us in that suffering. And the question is, how do we experience that? How do we embrace that? I wanted to share a story this morning that's sort of a family story of mine. I was talking earlier about looking back. This is sort of looking back even before I was born. It's a story I shared, I think I shared here, but quite a long time ago. So you may have forgotten it, and I'll get away with telling it again. But it's a story from the Second World War. Now, the Second World War is one of those stories that gets read or told certain ways, right? We have, it's generally told from the point of view of power. We think about leaders like Churchill and Hitler. We think about good versus evil, right? We all make our choices about that. We think of great acts of heroism. And, you know, I come from England. When a lot of the memories and stories that are told about the Second World War are the kind of like the plucky English courage that got us through the Blitz and got us through all those things. From an American perspective, the story is told as America riding in, kind of at the last minute, by the way, but and then rescuing rescuing Europe, you know. We all have a way of telling the story, right? But it tends to get told in a very, I think, when we look back, in a somewhat romanticized kind of fairy tale kind of way. And part of that is because we know the outcome, right? We know the end of the story. Now, in another way, the story is not over, right? There's all sorts of things that happened. The Second World War was the beginning of something in many respects. But that part of the story, anyway, we know how it resolved. And we can look back at it almost sort of nostalgically and romantically. I want to tell a little bit of this story, though, from somebody else's perspective. Maybe we can put that first slide up. And this is from the perspective of this woman who's at the time of the story I'm going to tell, she was 21 years of age. And this is, I think she's 19 at this point. And this is my grandmother on my mother's side, Mary MacDonald, Mary Lloyd, as she became. And she lived in a city in England called Hull, which I think we have a map of England. This is a more accurate map of the Holy Land. We were talking about travels in the Holy Land earlier. So I don't have my pointer on me, but about halfway up the British Isles, on the right-hand side, on the east side, is this city called Hull. It's on a river called the Humber, and it was at this time, back in the 1940s, it was a big shipping port. It's sort of been through lots of changes in more recent times, but it was a pretty significant city. And it became very significant in the early 40s, so not by 1941, which is where I'm going to set this story, it became very significant because Hitler had been attacking England. You know, we'd had the Blitz, or the Battle of Britain and the Blitz, and all those things were going on. And London was the main target, I mean, other cities too. But then the German attention shifted more towards Russia. And Britain was helping the Russians, and we were shipping munitions out to Russia because you can get across the North Sea and to Russia that way. And Hull was one of the main ports that was shipping out to Russia. So they decided to bomb the heck out of Hull. And it started off, there were a few raids here and there, and then there were several raids that were really devastating raids. Now, on July the 18th, it was, 1941, my grandmother, who I just showed you, was going to work, and she went to her mother's house, so my great-grandmother's house, to drop off her daughter, my mother, who was 2 years old at the time, and she wanted her to look after her. It was sort of late evening or late afternoon, and she was going to look after her that night. My grandmother was working a night job, and for some strange reason, her mother, my great-grandmother, said she can't stay here tonight, and I'm not exactly sure what happened there. All I know is it was a bit weird, and her mother was like, she just can't stay here, it doesn't work out, and my grandmother was actually pretty cross, pretty angry, had to take my mother to another friend's house and felt like she was imposing on her. It was all very, very inconvenient. That night, there was the worst air raid there's been, they just dropped, I forget the number of bombs, but it was a huge number of bombs onto Hull, and my grandmother's family, who were all at that house, went into the local shelter. And actually, it was the next door neighbor had the shelter. You know, there were shelters built, and not every house had its own shelter. So they went into the bomb shelter, and there was a direct hit on the bomb shelter. And so all of my grandmother's family were killed. So that was her mother, her father. She had 9 brothers and sisters. Only 2 of them survived, and that was because they were in there were two brothers who were fighting overseas, so they weren't there to go into the shelter. And it was this devastating moment in her life, absolutely devastating moment. She had to go the next day to identify, this is just horrible, identify body parts. There were lots of other people that died too, but it was mainly her family in this one particular shelter that got hit. And she was sort of pulling stuff out of the rubble. It was just, I can't imagine what that must have been like. One of the things she pulled out the rubble, I actually have here, which is a picture of her father. I think it's the next slide, yeah. So this is my great-grandfather, who I obviously never met. And my grandmother was very close to this man. He's got a very interesting story, actually, because nobody knows where he came from. He was a baby left on a doorstep. It's very hard for me to trace my family back, actually, both my mother's side and my father's side. We don't really do that much in England, though, actually. We don't trace our history like as much as you guys do here. Maybe that's why. I remember talking to my grandmother a lot about this event. I mean, she spent years not talking about it, but by the time I was a teenager, I'd ask her a lot of questions, and gradually she would begin to talk about it. And she told me about she, you know, going through the rubble, and she just found this picture. I'm gonna send it round. It's if you could just handle it carefully, because I want to keep it the rest of my life, obviously. But I'm gonna just pass it around. She fished that out. It just caught her eye as she was going through it. But she was pulling out all kinds of stuff out of the rubble. And that picture kind of represents the pain of loss, the loss of her grandfather, of her father, the loss of her family. And really, it represented something that was a massive part for the rest of her life, right? We talk about these stories, okay? The story of the Second World War, and we celebrate victory, and we celebrate freedom, we celebrate all these different things. But no amount of victory, no amount of celebration, no amount of grandiose plan or fairy tale or romance could in any way take away the pain, the reality of somebody like my grandmother who had no say in what happened, who doesn't view the plucky English spirit as this wonderful, great thing that got everybody through, but just thinks about that time as incredible grief, incredible trauma, incredible difficulty. But my grandmother persevered, right? She was not a particularly religious woman. I would say, honestly, she was a pretty hard and at times quite bitter woman. I think we could probably all say understandably. But she persevered. And I noticed probably about the time when I was a teenager, that for whatever reason, I was kind of special to my grandmother, sorry. I didn't realize I'd get emotional. But I realized that I was special to my grandmother. And I'm one of four, and I'm not even going to say that I was the favorite or anything like that. Though I think possibly that was the case. But she just attached to me and told me lots of stories about this event and other events in her life. And it turned out, I realized after a while, that she had a brother, and I think we have a picture of this guy. Do we have the picture? Yeah, George, who died in that shelter, who looked just like me. Now, I don't particularly think he looks like me, but for whatever reason, when I came along, I reminded her of George, and George was her favorite brother. And I think we've got some other pictures of George here when he grew up. So this was him round about the time that he died. Again, I don't particularly think I look like him, but for whatever reason, I reminded my mother of George. And she would talk to me a lot about this guy. We can keep going through the... Actually, that's something she pulled out. Another thing she gave to me, she pulled out George's birth certificate out of the rubble. I've got that at home as well. But and that's a picture of me when I was a little boy with my mother. Now, my mother, obviously, is this sort of glimmer of hope in that story, right? And I, you know, why did my great grandmother say, I can't look after my mother tonight? I don't know, you know, and was that God intervening? Was that like one of these kind of dream type things? If so, it sounds very wonderful. It also sounds really unfair, right? Because, well, why not everybody else? You know, and we have to wrestle with these mixtures, right, in our life, where we want to believe that God is present and working through things, but then in other situations, it seems like God is so absent, right? It can seem so unfair, so difficult. You know, I came along on the scene, and as I said, I was somewhat, you know, of a my grandmother, you know, the apple of her eye, let's say, to some degree, until my son came along. So George is the third of our kids, and where's Ollie? This is no offense to Ollie, because Ollie's the, you know, he's just this phenomenal fourth son. But for whatever reason, my grandmother thought that George looked even more like the previous George than I did, and suddenly I was out and George was in. And he does look a little bit more like those pictures, I think. I think we've got another picture of him here later on in life when he's a seasoned campaigner, George. There, so that's my grandmother. This is about, I don't know, so George is about three there probably, so that's about 17 years ago. So it's not long before my grandmother died. So that to me, that's an image of hope, right? That's an image of hope. My grandmother lived a very difficult life, a very hard life. And I think she was, if you talk to my mother, not an easy woman to live with, not an even easy woman to have as your mother. But what I see here is a woman who persevered, a woman who stayed with it, a woman who kept going, who didn't give up, who kind of accepted the reality of the pain that she was in, who was not looking for a magic wand to be waved for it all to go away, and obviously, you know, had no choices about that either, but who persevered through. And I guess what I want to get at this morning as we talk about this story in light of the Christmas story is this, that we have all kinds of things going on in our lives, right? If we were just to canvas the group here this morning, we may not have pulled relatives' body parts out of rubble. We haven't, thank God, had to go through those kinds of things, right? Some of us have been in, I'm sure, all kinds of very traumatic situations. Some of us have experienced things that we've probably shared with very few other people that are awful things. Some of us have done awful things, right? We've made really bad choices. Some awful things have happened to us. Some things have just happened because of circumstances and what might seem like luck. But we all, every single one of us, to some degree, struggles with things that seem out of our control and that don't seem to change. There may be relationships where we just wish that other person would behave differently or be different, and yet we have no control over that, no matter how hard we try, or how hard we try to manipulate that other person or get them to be different or whatever, you know, whatever relationship it is. There's all kinds of painful situations in our lives. And I'm not convinced that Christmas is telling us that one day everything's going to be okay, so don't worry, just hope in the future. It'll all be fine. There may be that sentiment to some degree at Christmas, but to me, that doesn't seem that miraculous, really. What seems miraculous is that God would come into all this pain with us, that God would come into this darkness. God would be present, walking through these situations with us, so that we can persevere, so that we can be in these situations. The miracle of Christmas is that God would be that vulnerable. The Christmas story shows not a God outside of the system moving all the pieces around, but a God in the system, subject to the system. It's like God is saying, okay, I'm going to be subject to Herod. I'm going to be subject to Quirinius, to Augustus Caesar. And my presence, my power, this different kind of power, is going to empower humanity to endure, to be in these difficulties. And I want us to think about it this morning. I mean, there's all kinds of ways we can think about this, but think about it in three ways. So let's sort of perhaps begin to relate to some of the situations that we ourselves struggle with, right? Some of those painful situations. I mean, some of us are facing death. Some of us are facing grief. Some of us are facing unbelievable loss. Some of us are trying to deal with incredible trauma. We're all working through stuff. As we think about those and feel some of those, perhaps even now, let's relate to them in three ways. First one is this, perseverance. I talked about that in terms of my grandmother, that the presence of God in our lives, Emmanuel, God with us, empowers us to keep on doing good, no matter what happens, no matter what happens to us, to keep on loving, to keep on staying on the side of hope and love rather than bitterness and victim and anger and hardness, right? That we can persevere in that way. We can, no matter what our situation is, we can keep going. We can be in that situation. We could think about it from the perspective of this week's theme, peace. That, and this is something I think we're talking about my grandmother, that she really struggled with. I don't think she was a woman that was at peace. She hadn't really come to a place of being able to deal with what she had been through and relate to it as a reality. So peace to me is, it's like rest. Whatever situation we're in, can we, without condoning that situation, without saying that situation is good, or even saying we don't want that situation to change. We may still want the situation to change, of course, but can we come to terms with that situation to the point where we would be at rest in it, in our circumstances, still persevering, still struggling, but can we be at rest where we would actually begin to open our hearts up and say, what needs to take place in my life? What healing needs to happen? How does my approach, my attitude, the things that I can control, how do they need to change? How can I love better? How can I do more good? How can I grow as a result of this situation I'm in? And I don't in any way want to minimize the enormity of some of the situations that we face. But for me, the miracle of Christmas is this miracle of peace, that God comes into the situation and says, be at peace. God doesn't come waving a magic wand, making everything better, and now you can be at peace. But God comes into the situation, into the darkness, and brings peace, brings a sense of rest, a sense of, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And then the third thing, not surprisingly, I think, is love. Can we, in all of this darkness, can we love? For me, the greatest miracle of Christmas is that love comes into this darkness. Love comes into this suffering. Love comes into this pain. And we can think about that as perhaps at a very personal level. Like when bad stuff happens to us, we frequently think we've done something wrong. It's our fault. We may even think that about other people. If something happens to somebody, we think, oh, well, yeah, they can't be a good person. I mean, all kinds of wacky thoughts come into mind. But we think of that, about that with ourselves especially. I've lost count of the number of people I've talked to who I've just simply had to say, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. This doesn't make you a bad person. In fact, I try to call out in that person, it's incredible how you've endured. It's incredible how you haven't caved under all that has happened to you. But very frequently, our first human instinct is to think we've done something wrong. And we translate that, unfortunately, into religious dogma, which is, you know, God doesn't like us. That God thinks we're really bad until proved otherwise. And God is quite happy to dish out all this death and judgment because we deserve it anyway. So perhaps stage one of love is saying, in this situation I'm struggling with, I'm just going to put aside any sense of blaming myself. I might need to put certain things right. I might need to change certain behaviors. But this, I'm going to start from the perspective that God loves me, that God is for me, accepts me, totally loves me. And then I'm going to start thinking, how can I show love in this situation? Show love to my enemies, show love to the people that are hurting me. How can I allow this situation even to produce love in me? And how can I, therefore, love other people? Now, I think this is a crucial thing, particularly where it relates to my grandmother's story. Because, as I mentioned, I don't think my grandmother was an easy person to grow up with, and my mother grew up with her as her mother. But I saw my mother love my grandmother in a way that, in some ways, my grandmother didn't deserve, given how she had treated my mother. And we have this. So hope in any situation, there's hope, maybe retrospective hope you could call it, in that story I just shared, which is my mother loving my grandmother. My grandmother found it hard to love, but my mother could love her. And we get a chance in life to bring hope into situations by loving people who are difficult to love. And people are often difficult to love because of their backstory, right? We all have people in our lives. So let's just narrow it down to work, okay, so we don't get too personal. But we all have people in our lives who are a pain in the neck, right? Just run the list now. And you're just like, every time they email you, every time they say something, it's like, oh, gosh, you know that. Okay, that's just normal part of life. That person has a backstory. That person has a reason why they may be difficult. And obviously, you know, we might find them difficult because it's us, right? We're the problem. But think about people's backstories and why people are the way they are. We have this opportunity in the here and now, in that darkness, in that difficulty, in that situation, to bring hope because we can love those people. I have been able to love my mother, and I hope my kids love me. But we have this opportunity to move away from that darkness through love, right? We can overcome that fear. We can overcome bitterness. We can overcome it through love. But that's not just for us. That's us loving other people, putting love and hope and light into other situations by the way that we treat people. So as we come to, we're going to close out here. I'm going to light this the second candle for peace. Maybe we could just put the lights down a fraction. we've got a prayer that's going to come up on the screen that we're going to say together in a second. But I'm just going to light this candle, and I want us to reflect for a moment. I hope it's going to light. Oh, yeah, there it goes. Well, that's a really bad omen. It's going to go out. What happened there? This is the candle that represents peace. Wait for it. It's the season of Advent, the season of waiting. Oh, well. This is the other thing. Was it you, Jermaine? You said that nothing goes according to plan, right? You said that the plan changes. So we've got a dud candle. there we go. So here's the candle of peace. We're just going to take a minute here. And in a moment, a prayer will appear on the screen, and we're going to pray that together in a second, not just right now. But I just want to step, I'm going to step out of the way here. Just focus on these candles. These candles represent hope and peace. Let's just take a moment of silence and just let those situations in your own life, there may be thoughts, right? You're thinking about something, a dark situation. You may be feeling that situation right now. It may be a historical situation. It may be a present situation. It may be a fear about the future. It might even be just looking at the world, right? Situations in the world that just weigh almost hopelessly on us. And let's just take a moment to reflect and invite God's presence, God with us, in those three areas of perseverance, peace and rest, and love. Okay, so let's just take a moment. Okay, let's pray this prayer together, and then the band are going to play for us. God, we confess that in all our busyness, our stress, and even our excitement, we often miss you. We open our hearts to your presence. God, you are in us, and we are in you. We are one. We embrace your hope in us and in the world. As we light this candle, may our hearts find rest in your heart. We receive your peace, and may peace fill all the world. Amen. Let's pray. Lord, thank you that you are with us, that we, at this time of year, we especially celebrate, recognize,